I recorded this interview today at my place in Buenos Aires because the internet at my office went down. This interview is sponsored by WooFoo. Try this. Go to WooFoo.com, create a new form, a new contact form for your website today. Embed it on your website, and if you find that people are writing emails that are way too long, you can just go to WooFoo and limit the size of the emails that you get. If you discover that you need more information from your from people who are contacting you before you can give them a proper response, you can add another field within seconds and it instantly gets changed on your website. Go to WooFoo.com, create your forms, and embed them on your website for free right now. This interview is also sponsored by Grasshopper. It's a virtual phone system that entrepreneurs love, and I know you already have a phone number, but consider porting your phone number to Grasshopper. If you do, before calls come to you, they'll be screened. After they come to you, you can handle them online, you can direct callers to different extensions, and you can make all the calls that you get a lot more manageable. Check out grasshopper.com and you'll see why I have a phone number from Grasshopper. Finally, my interviews are sponsored by Shopify. In addition to giving you an online store that you can create quickly and be up and running with all the features that you need, I'm noticing now that Shopify is doing interviews with people like Seth Godin and bringing you all kinds of tips from them about how you can grow your store. So they're not just setting you up with a store, they're also helping you sell with that store. Go to Shopify.com, you can create your store, add it to your existing business. If you already have a content-based business, you can sell online too. Go to Shopify.com and see what they have to offer. All right, here's the program. Hey everyone, it's Andrew Warner, founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart, with an audio-only interview because we're having a little bit of technical trouble. But I've got with me one of the leaders, in fact, maybe even the leading expert in search engine optimization. His name is Aaron Wall. He is the founder of SEO Book. And when I used to do live events and bring out entrepreneurs, investors, search engine optimization experts to come in and talk to my audience, whenever they talked about SEO, they would always tell the audience, go check out SEObook.com. Go check out the tools on there. I always used to say, well, if they're all referring to this guy, if all these experts that I'm bringing out on stage are referring to this guy, why don't I bring him on to Mixergy and do an interview with him? And I finally got to do an interview with Aaron Wall. He has been mentioned by tons of well-known publications, including Wall Street Journal, PBS, New York Times. All these guys refer to him when they need to teach their people, their audiences, how to do search engine optimization right. He has a 250,000 registered members on his website, and about 1,000 of them are paying members. And paying members on your site, Aaron, tell me if I'm wrong, means they're paying you $300 a month to learn search engine optimization?
It depends. The new members, that's the rate. What we did is we used pricing to help control demand. So when we first launched, it was actually like $50 per month for the first 100 people. Then it went to 100, and then I started fixing a lot of conversion issues, and we raised it to 150. And then it was still like, the site was growing like quite a bit still. So then we closed down, we closed it down to new subscribers for about 2.5, almost 3 months. And then when we reopened, we did it at 300. So we also do a lot of web publishing and stuff too. So we're always balancing out resources between trying to grow this site and make it as good as we can, with not having too many members, while also being able to work on other stuff and learn from it too, because there's a symbiotic relationship between publishing stuff and learning from it and then teaching SEO, and they both feed off each other.
Okay, so here's my agenda for the program here today. I want to find out how you built your business. How are you selling content online to people who are smart enough to know that there's free content everywhere on the internet? How did you get here? Second thing I want to do is go over some search engine optimization tips from you. My concern in doing that is that in a short program like this, I want to make sure to get to some of the unique things, because so many people in the audience already are familiar with search engine optimization techniques, and I don't want to give them the same old stuff that they can find and just anywhere. And then the third thing we've got to do, the audience is talking about it, I know I've wanted to talk to you about this. You've had a couple of run-ins with, actually, you've called out Mahalo. You've said that they're doing mm-hmm. things that are a little bit shady. I know from our conversations before this interview that you don't want to spend a lot of time talking about Mahalo, and you have certain reluctance to talk about certain aspects of that. But we got to talk at least a little bit about the big issues there. Fair?
Sure.
Okay. All right. Let's start out with how you got here. You started off, as I understand it, in 2003. What did you launch with in 2003?
So my first site in 2003, going like way back to the beginning, was actually kind of a like a rant site that wasn't very good. And then I got like I learned a little bit about affiliate marketing, created like the world's thinnest, least value e-commerce sort of like mall site. Like, well, I can put affiliate links on it, and it wasn't very good either. But I soon learned that, search was certainly where there was a lot of value in traffic. And from that, I created a site called search-marketing.info, where it was basically mainly like notes to myself about how you would do SEO or stuff I was learning about, basically. And when it was kind of like raw HTML, and when I say this, I mean like kind of like 1998 gray background, almost kind of bad. Some artist from he was a painter from New Jersey, and he came across that site and he wanted to hire me to sell services, and I really didn't want to because I still thought I was so new and still learning. And he was very persistent, so he hired me, and then I tried my best and he got good results. And then around the time in 2003, I worked for a few more clients then, started gaining more confidence, had a few more of my own sites, and they were starting to do well. And then Google did what they called the Google Florida update.
Actually, let's stop it
And
right there. I know the Google
okay.
Florida update happened in November 2003, and I want to get into that because I know it's a turning point. But I also want to understand how you got to this. When you had that rant site that was the first one, rant, RANT for the transcribers, what do you mean by that? What was it, and what was the purpose of it?
It wasn't Well, so I didn't like something. It was literally just imagine like a rant website that was just, it wasn't like a very good website. So it's not a great website. It was just like it was basically something I was just ranting about. So.
Okay, so something would bother you, you'd go on and you'd rant. You weren't even using necessarily blogging software, you were just ranting in HTML.
Yeah,
Okay.
basically. And there was, yeah, and towards the end of 2003, not only was there the Florida update, but also something I saw in 2003 was that a lot of sites that were using blogging software would get all these reference links just because it was so easy for people to subscribe to them. So that's part of the reason which borne out the idea of creating a blog about SEO. That's part of the reason I shifted over from that search marketing info site to the SEO book blog.
I see. So search-marketing.info, one of the worst domain names out there, I think. Actually, what do you think of that? You're a guy who knows domain names better than me. What do you think?
As far as the domain name, it sucks. The
Okay.
info extension is generally synonymous with spam because almost every year there seems to be a special like where you either get 99-cent or 89-cent dot info domains. So people register like Q93P8 dot info, and throw up some spam junk on there because the marginal cost is so low. Also, hyphens in domain names are horrible generally because it's you have to say the hyphen, and when you say the hyphen, it sounds like it has to be emphasized and it sounds weird. And if you try to do any sort of branding, that's just not good.
Yeah, frankly, I don't even think most people know what hyphens are. It's amazing that they don't, but they don't seem to. Okay, then you go on and you create an affiliate site. Or essentially, what you said was it's a thin website with nothing but links out to affiliate programs. The goal there was just to make money, and you were just testing out ideas. Am I understanding it right?
Yeah, and there's a couple of funny stories on that one is when I had that site, the first one I made there, that was before I started selling any SEO stuff or anything like that, and before I learned anything about SEO, I had that site, and then I hired someone to do SEO stuff for it, and frankly, the site was terrible. So anyone who really knew SEO wouldn't want to do SEO for it because there was not much value on the site there, and they'd rather promote something better. However, I hired someone, they didn't do a very good job. And then that's sort of what spurred me to learn SEO. Also back then with that website, I misspelled a couple words on it back then, and actually ranked for a few of them, and was one of a few results for the misspelling of a online casino's name in Yahoo directory. So that actually created a little bit of cash flow for a bit until I knew what I was doing later on. So. It helped a lot.
You know what? It's funny. This interview is going to be transcribed. The transcribers are going to get typos all over the place. And it's not a bad thing because anytime somebody searches for a word that's just a little bit off, I've got a potential of showing up in the search engine results I'm learning. In fact, I get a lot of traffic from these typos. I could go back in and correct them. I thought of hiring somebody and having them fix it, but figure why? This is good traffic. True.
Right, it's they're lower competitive keywords, so easy to rank for.
Okay, but the affiliate site, in retrospect, it's kind of a spammy site, no?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It wasn't because I didn't understand enough about the web to understand. So I like figured out like, oh wow, there's affiliate programs, so I could just create this cool site and have all these options. I didn't appreciate the depth you can do on a specific topic, or how bad it, or how hard it is to create something that's both great and in-depth and then broad. So I mean, I didn't stick with that site very long. Actually, it's not even published online anymore.
Okay, what made you realize that search was the answer? And the reason I'm asking is when we're starting something new, we're groping around looking to figure out where the hit is, where what makes sense for us, what we're going to be excited about. And you're searching around for a little bit and suddenly you hit on something that let you get really big. So I'm curious about how you discovered it so the rest of us can also discover our next hit.
So with search, I mean, a lot of it kind of seemed almost a bit obvious because like a lot of the ad programs that were also targeted, I tried some of those and stuff, and you would see how certain keywords would be worth more. And then like if you tried buying other forms of advertising, if you did any sort of tracking at all, like if your site wasn't really super fine-tuned for conversions, if you were buying other sorts of advertising, you could throw tons of traffic at a site and still have no conversions at all. Whereas with search, you could throw some traffic at it and you'd still get some conversions out of it, even if not a lot. If it's a bad site, it's not going to make that many conversions. But the difference in targeting is so amazing. And then the other thing is since I was so new to the web, I wasn't, immediately a conversion expert or any of these other sort of topics. So this a lot of the people who are attracted to SEO, I think part of it is they like the idea of getting free traffic. It's not necessarily entirely free, it takes a lot of effort to get it. But the thing is, with a lot of web businesses, like say with a lot of the ad networks, you have to keep refining what you're doing and increasing value, and then keep handing larger chunks over to the ad network because your competitor is doing the same thing. Whereas with SEO, if you can get a strong enough position and become associated with certain concepts, you kind of keep the profit margin rather than have it slowly erode.
I see what you mean. I want to get into that, and I'm going to make a promise to my audience right now. We are going to give them some techniques that they can use to get not free traffic, in the sense that it's going to cost them time, but it's going to be free because they won't have to buy it from search engines. Can we make that promise together?
Yep,
Okay. All right.
sure.
So let's move on then to SEO Book. How did you start SEO Book? How did Google's Florida update lead to SEO Book?
So what happened was in November 2003, Google did a pretty major update, and after they did it, a lot of the SEO companies were kind of just scrambling because all their clients were angry because, or large chunks of clients would be angry because certain sorts of sites had go up, certain would drop, and the types of sites that drop were often the ones that were kind of aggressive with link anchor text, and mostly they're based on kind of manipulative or aggressive practices, whereas the types of sites that rose tended to be the ones that had kind of more of a natural backlink profile. Well, when you hire an SEO, ideally, eventually, you develop a somewhat natural link profile, but part of that is, you try to get the best returns you can, and sometimes that means being a bit aggressive. Until Google did that update, SEO was basically pick the keyword you want to rank for, buy as many links as you can with that keyword in the link anchor text, and you'd rank. And then suddenly it was way different after that update, where you had to vary the link anchor text, Certain links count, certain ones didn't. There was all kinds of they were also looking at how you did your on-page stuff and comparing to link stuff. So whereas before that update, you would do like if you wanted to rank for something, you would make it very obvious that you wanted the page to be targeted towards that keyword in the page title, in the page heading, in almost all the link anchor text. You'd be very overt about targeting it. And then after that, it became a bit more refined in that. So I wrote an article about that update, and it I went kind of from being pretty darn obscure to like being well enough known to where kind of people knew who I was, which was kind of weird how quickly it changed. And then I started getting lots of calls from people who wanted consulting stuff, and I would do some of them, but I couldn't do all of them because there was so much. And then within a month, that sort of, popularity, a lot of it sort of died down or dropped off. So I thought that, consulting is kind of a bit of a feast or famine sort of business model where you get, suddenly popular and then a lot of it dies down. And then, so I thought it might make sense to have something of a, like, sort of like an info product or something between, something that was between like selling a full-on consulting package and just only publishing your own site. So I thought there was some way to do something in the middle to service the market.
Did I lose you?
No,
No, good.
can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. I thought we lost the conversation. Okay, so you're realizing what a lot of people in the consulting business realize, which is it's a tough business. Even if you're doing really well, it's your hours that are bringing in the money, and you only have so many hours in the day. And what you decided to do as a result of that was
To launch an ebook
okay.
on the topic.
Why'd you decide to launch an ebook and not grow a blog where you can sell advertising and maybe even bring in more traffic than the average blog because you had a better sense of search engine optimization?
So I would say that we do pull in more traffic than most of the if you compare on there's companies with like dozens of employees that have similar traffic profiles to our small little company. We definitely do pull in lots of traffic, but the thing is, in SEO, most of people aren't the type of people who really click on ads. So there's not a large sum of people who you can sell ads to, and have them profitably want to advertise month after month after month. I mean, if you compare click-through rates on different classifications of websites, there's some sorts of sites where if you're pretty aggressive with the ad integration, you can get a 20% click-through rate on some of the ads. Whereas with SEO, you're lucky to get a half a percent or a quarter of a percent if you're talking about the SEO topic.
I see. Okay. All right. Fair enough. So you realize that there's not enough money in advertising. You've got to create your own product. Why did you decide on an ebook out of all the products you could have created? Maybe an audio book you could have done, or a video series, or doing what you eventually did in 2007, which is charge subscriptions. Why an ebook first?
So back then, I would say that I didn't have. So I was, I would say I was new and naive enough to think my knowledge was better than it actually was, just because I was compared to what I know today, certainly. But I wasn't necessarily. I didn't have all the skills of like being able to do the videos, set up the programming stuff for running a membership site and all these other things. But I did think that an ebook could be priced at a reasonable price to where people could afford to get it. And you could provide updates as kind of like a service with it, and still make it a pretty darn good product and make it fairly affordable. And there was a common thread or line of thought on the web, which was that all SEO books are out of date. You don't want an SEO book, blah blah blah. So that actually was part of the angle for like explaining why the ebook was good. Hey, this is current, it's up to date.
Gotcha.
So that was why I went with that off the start.
Okay, at its height, how much money did it bring in a month, the book?
Trying to think. I actually didn't track the numbers as well as a lot of people would. The I would say steady state per day, maybe it would sell 10 units or something
10 units at
like that.
how much per?
So, like $79 or something like that.
Wow, so you charge $79 for the book on average, you're saying 10 books a day for almost $800 a day? And how did you get the customers to come in and buy it? How'd you get them into your site even?
So our site has a bunch of free tools on it that you've heard a lot of people recommend them. So that was part of that. Plus the blog, a lot of people would subscribe to it. And we have an affiliate program. So we have a bunch of affiliates. And then also we have I would do a bit of like AdWords or AdSense sort of marketing. And the thing is, like the ads would maybe appear on a forum in the space, and someone would see the ad on one of the public forums, and they'd say, "Hey, I just saw an ad for this SEO book site. Is it any good?" And then since we had a lot of past customers who liked us and thought our product was good, a lot of those would turn into like testimonial threads, and then that day there'd be an extra $1,000 of sales or something.
Dan Blank is saying Aaron seems like a kind of guy who will tell you all about his earnings numbers, and a few other people have said earlier in the chat room that you're very open. Dan Blank also calculated that it's $24,000 a month on ebook, which he says is nice. That's just sales though, and what portion of that was expenses?
See, that's the thing is I would go to a lot back then. I would go to almost all the conferences, then you had hosting, and I was creating all the tools, had updated. So there was still a lot of expenses in running the site too. I'm like I said, I was the type of person who towards the end of the year would kind of calculate stuff out, but I wouldn't really every month say, "Oh, I got to grow 5% or 10%." I felt if I was too focused on the short term numbers or trajectory, that sometimes you don't always control all that sort of stuff, and sometimes I get burnt out that way. So I just kind of figure that if I do well enough with a lot of this stuff, then to some degree the numbers will kind of go where they should.
But you know what? That's surprising because I take a look at your website now. The first thing I see is an offer to buy. If I stay on the site, I think for a few seconds, a pop-up comes up asking me for my email address to register. You seem like somebody who's not passive about growing his business and making sales, but is actually doing some things that other people would shy away from. So I always thought of you as somebody who's a little bit more active. Is that
So
is
that was actually there's a couple contradictions in that. So I think my approach to business was kind of really passive off the start with some certain aspects anyway. And then over time it got more aggressive, and a big piece of that was actually my wife. So I met her in, I think it was, let's see, like 2006. It was towards the end of the year, and she was actually the person who kind of pushed for making the membership site sort of idea. And some of the stuff on the site more recently is we worked with conversion rate experts, and they helped improve some of the conversion flow path. And we even tested a pop-up for a while, and it didn't. We don't use the pop-up on many of the pages because it didn't resonate with the sort of Are the people who end up being our customers are usually kind of more towards the expert or pretty experienced sort of level, whereas a lot of the more aggressive marketing stuff, it didn't resonate as well. About the only thing that kind of did okay without pulling the wrong audience in was kind of like the slide up sort of thing at the bottom.
Yeah, that's that thing that comes up. It takes about the bottom 10% of the screen, gets people's attention, but isn't distracting. And there's always a hyperlink there that says, I never want to see this pop up again, or something to that effect. And so that's what's worked for you. That's what you're doing now. We talked about earlier, subscriptions. When you turn to subscriptions, what was the audience's reaction?
So there, I think that when you charge people recurring, that getting the conversions is a lot harder than when you're just doing one-off. Because when you're doing a one-off purchase that's under $100, you can get a lot of just impulse conversions, like where people, "Oh, sure, I'll try it out." And Once you go to charging recurring, it's a heck of a lot harder to get people to convert. So the initial reaction to when we launched was, I've been on the web since like 2003, so we had, a good number of brand fans. We were able to launch it and get it up and rolling pretty good almost right away. There was some technical issues with the programming of it, but I think it was pretty well received. But what you'll find out though is the people. Whenever you sell people, there's like a life lessons about like trying to help people for free and then them not respecting it or like it. But then if people pay for it, then they'll act on the information because they're invested in the result, and they respect it more. Well, I think a lot of that goes that way too. I think part of what I had to learn to do is back when I used to do the ebook model, I would answer way too many questions via email, and I'd help a lot of people out, like way more. People would often get more from me just shooting me emails than they would get from a lot of firms they pay $5,000 or $10,000 for. And then I just started telling people, like, look, if you have a good question, ask it in our subscriber forums, and what that did is it gave me a venue to discuss SEO and search with the people who care to value my time, while allowing me to filter out a lot of people who wanted as much as my labor as they could get, so long as it was free.
Sorry, I'm reading some of the comments here. People are saying Andrew's taking notes on this thing. He's concocting his entire subscription strategy for Mixergy based off this call. No, you know what though? But every little bit helps. And yes, I absolutely, when I do an interview, I want to learn a lot for myself. And I also want the people in the audience to be taking notes and to go out there and use this themselves too. And every time I get an email from someone who listens to one of my programs and actually uses some of these ideas and comes back to me with the results, that to me is heaven. I love to see that. So I use it. I want you guys to use it. It's all in the open here. That's why I'm also asking sharp questions here. I actually heard, Aaron, that there was some pushback. That's why I asked you that question. When people saw that I was going to be interviewing you, a few of them emailed me in my audience and said, Andrew, check in with Aaron because I think there was a little bit of a firestorm when he started selling. Did you hear any of that, or did it just seem like it on
So
the
it's
outside?
not. Well, I think it's you have to. There's on the internet marketing space. There's a bit of like freetard culture stuff, and what it is like everything's supposed to be free all the time, and eventually people just got to get over that. So, sometimes I'll still write about like when people do some of that sort of stuff where people like try to bully you on Twitter or on their blog or something about like or send you this long email about how they're distraught because you actually charge for providing a service. But the thing is, that seems to be a general trend of the web, and it doesn't seem to be getting any better. But the truth is, if you let those people influence your decision making too much, then all you're doing is sacrificing your own quality of life to like appease a bunch of abusive, worthless sacks of crap that don't care about you. So, you'll always get blowback whenever you try to charge for something, but you can't internalize it too much because it's mostly just a reflection of those people's internal lack of self-esteem and internal lack of value that they're trying to flip out onto you.
And I see Tim Berkwin's in the audience right now. He's a guy who teaches how to set up membership sites, and he's actually done an interview here with me on Mixergy. I'm sure what you're saying here is warming his heart because he said the same thing. Okay, what was the first package that you offered to members? What was included in that?
So so we have a forum where people can discuss SEO stuff.
Okay,
We
a
have a
forum
number of
meaning.
SEO tools,
Meaning the bulletin form?
yep, exactly, vBulletin, yep. So it's a vBulletin forum, and then we give away some tools for free, but then we also have like about a half dozen or two dozen or so in our members area, and then we also have what we call training modules, which are basically sometimes there's a video in them, there's lots of pictures in them, and it's kind of just broken down by topic, where it's kind of you can almost think of it about it like it's like a Wikipedia about SEO and then some other related internet marketing areas.
Okay, so it was, and this was all in the beginning, the forum, the classes essentially, the modules that you were saying,
So,
the tools.
it was easy to do because off the start, what I did is I kind of took what used to be an ebook and then kind of broke it down and tried to clean it up, add more stuff to it. Okay, we could have a video here, or let's expound on this area here. So I did that stuff in the background, and then when I was kind of done editing it and comfortable with the format of it, at that point, then we launched. And we didn't have as many tools off the start as we have today, so we've definitely added a bunch of those over time. But off the start, we had what was going to be a monthly newsletter, the training modules, the forum, and then a few private tools.
Okay, I want to get back into this, but I got to take a step in. I've got to take a step in another direction and ask you about the tools. I heard about SEO Book because of the free tools that you've offered forever on the website. Somebody in the audience asked me to ask you, how did you get those tools made? You're not a developer yourself, right?
No, I used to be so I used to kind of weird background. I used to be a nuclear reactor operator in the Navy, and on the submarine there was another guy with me who worked with me that was in my division, who knew all about kind of web stuff and programming. And our first tool that was a big hit was called SEO for Firefox. He made that for me. I had to make that, so that's how I got that one. And then as far as from there, sometimes I would have friends make some one-off tools here or there that I liked, or stuff that I thought would be cool to have, or features that I thought would be neat. And also at one point in time, some Romanian programmer sold me a bunch of SEO scripts pretty cheap, and they weren't perfect, and a lot of them I didn't really use. But one of them was the basis for what became our keyword tool, and then I just kind of started hacking with the PHP to add features to it, and I mean that in the loosest sense. Like, I'm not any good at programming. We later upgraded to that to be powered by Word Tracker, and we also have a programmer now that works for us full time.
Okay. I ask because it seems like the tools are bigger draw even than the articles. The people talk about the tools because there aren't a lot of sites that have them, and I'm feeling like the rest of us should probably have some tools too, and you could probably go out to Elance and have them done, or as you did, get a friend to create a couple.
Yeah, and the key is, like, the more unique you can make them, like, if they're satisfying, like how you mentioned with the interviews, where sometimes you're scratching your own itch. If you can create some stuff that's the stuff you want for you because you think it's would be really useful for you and save you time, then those are the type of ones that'll be really well received by others.
Okay, all right, and then going forward to the membership site, when you launched it with a forum. Most people can't get a forum populated for free. Here you've got a gate where you're charging people. How are you managing to get a conversation going in this forum in the beginning?
So we had a number of different streams we could use. I had my blog, which people, subscribe to and see, and some of them would be interested in it. We also had our old ebook subscribers, and I gave some of them like a trial account that converted into a paid account after they stayed for a while. So some of them joined from that. And then on the blog, when we mentioned it there, also the first 100 people got a half off coupon. So between those two, that kind of helped get it up and going and kind of running. And then from there, as the promotional value of those kind of faded slightly over time, it just kept building on its own.
Okay, that's the way to get people to be registered members of the forum. How do you get them to start interacting on the forum?
Well, that's what I was saying is, well, how do you get them to interact?
Yeah.
I think a lot of that comes down to, if you promptly answer people's questions and you give them really good answers, and you try to set an example of being really helpful, you'll find that some other people will do the same thing. Like, some of our moderators do an awesome job, and even some of our people that are paying to be our customers still, help out a lot with each other. So it's. I think it's just if you work hard and you try to share a lot of value, that it's kind of contagious, and a lot of people do it as well.
So in the early days, it was you answering questions the way that you used to answer questions by email, you adding a lot of value yourself, and then others started adding it too. Fair?
Yeah, and I mean, it was almost instantaneous with others. Like, we have some really, really great members that have been there like from the first day,
How did
and
you
it's
get
now like
good
a couple
members in
years
the
later.
beginning to, I'm sorry, the overlap is just because of the Skype issues. How did you get people in the early days to participate in to be as helpful as they were? How did you get those moderators? How'd you get them to be so helpful?
So I think well, I didn't like appoint any moderators off the start. Like, hey, do you want to be a moderator? I'm about to launch a site. What I did is I took some of the people that were some of the most helpful people, and I asked them if they wanted to become moderators. So that's and then as far as how we got it, I think if you have, I mean, if you have a site that's out there that has, you know, thousands of existing articles or pieces of content, and you have any form of kind of advertisement on it, you're going to pull in like a stream of people from that. And if you're pretty consistent in the way you talk and what you say and that sort of stuff, I think you'll pull in people who eventually become loyal to that sort of brand or are interested in having more conversation like related to that, but maybe they're but more focused on, you know, their needs or, you know, marketing their site and such.
Merrick in the audience, one of the best contributors here to the live events. Merrick is saying, Aaron also bought a forum in the past called ThreadWatch. There was crossover. So, did you buy a forum that you were able then to get some of those members over to your site?
I would say there was certainly some crossover in membership. However, I closed one, and then it was a while before I opened the other. But it wasn't. But part of why I had to close ThreadWatch is, remember how earlier how we mentioned how you know, ad-based models in the SEO space don't really work that well?
Yep.
Well, that was a site that was primarily tried to aim to be kind of ad-oriented, but kind of related to SEO stuff, and the thing is, it was a bit probably too snarky and cynical, and it just it was you couldn't really build a business off of it based of how it was set up. Like, it was set up to where it was almost like a like kind of like a Gawker website in the SEO space.
Okay. All right, Christmas in the audience says that he used to be a subscriber of yours, and he says he currently ranks top 10 on Google for a keyword that costs over $4,000 a day on AdWords. I'd love to hear a little bit more from you on what that is. Tell me in the comments. Christmas365 is his name. He says SEO book can teach you a lot of tactics. Then why'd you cancel, by the way, Christmas? Tell us why you canceled. Did you get enough value? Did you find that at some point it was repetitive? I'm curious about that too. Okay, at its height, how much did SEO Book, the membership site, bring in? We got disconnected. What you were saying before we got disconnected was you prefer not to be the guy holding up the check. It's just not the kind of reputation that you want out there. Is there a number you can say that you make over then? Can we say over $1 million a year from memberships, or would you feel comfortable with some kind of number like that, even if it's a fuzzy number?
It wouldn't be that high. And then also, you got to remember we have a full-time programmer. Our host costs like over $1,000 a month. We have people who help out like in the forums or on the blog. So there's a lot of cost to it too. The site, it's not the highest margin project I've ever worked on. It's just one that that's a topic that interests me, so it's easy to spend a lot of time doing.
Ah, I see. What other sites do you have?
See, we don't disclose most of those because people burn sites because of who you like. With SEO stuff, you get people who go out of their way to try to burn your stuff just because you're you. And that's part of, to tie it into the sort of Mahalo angle. Certain sites, larger sites, can kind of get like, oh, well, you're a big brand, so you're the benefit of the doubt, and that's all fine. Whereas if you're an SEO, people actively try to witch hunt your stuff. And like, rather than you getting the benefit of the doubt, or like, you know, it's just like, oh, you know, shoot first, ask questions later. So it's just like, it's if I could be anything other than an SEO and still be, you know, well known at marketing, I'd love it because then I'd be able to talk about my other sites a lot more. But Some people, they say, oh, well, here's how you do this or that, and they provide like a really good tip and show you the site they did it on, and then a Google engineer says, why is this jerk exposing this publicly? Screw him, I'm gonna burn his site. And then your site's banished from the web.
I see. You're saying that Google sees that you're exposing how to top the ratings, how to top the search engine results, and because they know that it's you exposing these secrets, they burn your other websites, meaning they don't show up in the search engine results. Okay, so
Yeah, so that's kind of how it works.
all right, you got to give
It's
me another.
retribution. There's a good video. Okay, so there's a good video a guy named Jeremy Shoemaker slash Shoe Money made. I think you interviewed him in the past.
You bet.
He made a video called Don't Make Google Look Stupid, and it talked about that.
Okay. All right. Fair. We've got to give the audience another 25 minutes. I know that you and I are at the top of the hour and we need to end the conversation, but I feel like I owe it to them to give them a full hour with you. You cool with that?
Yep, sure.
Thanks. Okay, all right. I wanted to go into the SEO tips right now, but since you brought up Mahalo and the difference between the way big companies and small companies are treated, let's talk about that. Why don't we have you first explain the issue in a
Okay,
little bit more depth?
so with SEO, there's guidelines, and they're like, this can be spammy. This can be clean, and then there's this kind of whole shades of gray area in the middle where it's like, well, that's kind of spammy, but it looks sort of legit, or well, that's person X's website, so they probably meant to spam, so screw them.
Oh, did we just lose him? Sorry. Oh man, we're getting just to the good stuff.
Here you do.
Sorry. Oh, you're back. We just lost you. So you were saying, I don't even remember at what point we lost you. You were saying that with SEO, that there's that it's who you know and how big your site are that influences Google sometimes, right?
Yeah, so the larger sites can usually get away with kind of being spammier, whereas kind of the smaller independent sites that aren't backed by venture capitalists or large corporations are usually held to like kind of a higher standard. So
Can
like
you
the
give me
bigger sites are
two
given the benefit of
examples?
the doubt, whereas
Let's give people an understanding what this is. Can
okay,
you give me two
so
examples?
yeah, well, so a great example would be like, for example, like that Mahalo site. So he was taking, I don't know if you know that at its height, they had like 300,000 or 400,000 pages that weren't 100% entirely machine generated and wrapped in ads, and that was ranking in the search results, and that was somehow fine. Whereas in the past, there was a guy named Tico was his nickname, TEECEO. And if you look on the Matt Cutts blog, he mentions that I know the stuff Tico was doing back then, and it was shoot on site. And that's how he described scraper sites. And yet, Mahalo wrapped in brand and all that, same sort of thing, same concept. However, it's legitimate and it flies, you know?
What about what Jason Calacanis, the founder of Mahalo, says, which is that it's a small percentage of his sites, and it seems like he's experimenting with new ideas, and maybe Google needs to understand that bigger sites need to experiment, and this is what seems big to most sites is a small-scale experiment to these bigger sites.
So the thing is, when you're experimenting, let's say an experiment, a small experiment shouldn't be 90 plus percent of the pages on your site. A small experiment is maybe you throw two or three pages out there and that's your experiment, or something like that. But it shouldn't be 90 something percent of your site if it's a small experiment. And it's fine if you want to experiment. However, if you're auto-generating pages, why should you immediately have the right to arbitrage Google search results with? So here's how it works. So right now, you're spending your time interviewing me, and then someone's going to spend time transcribing it. And there's all these labor costs that go into creating content, your time, my time, hosting, so on and so forth, right? And then a lot of these third-party sites that just kind of scrape a bunch of content, wrap it in ads, and then put your content that's scraped kind of below the fold. So it's the search engine sees it, but it's just there to kind of pull in visitors and try to get them to suck off an ad click. Well, the problem with that right now is that like kind of the media system as a whole is kind of collapsing on itself to where it's not profitable. And a lot if there's a lot of kind of what they like to Google has a if there's a lot of thin no value add sites in the middle, then they're just sucking off of whoever is putting in effort. So it's like everyone else is taking a pay cut because they're not getting all the traffic they should for their own content because someone just snagged some of their content and threw it on some crappy auto-generated page. So if you look at it from that sort of perspective, Google views some pages as having added value and utility for users, some pages as having none, and then that's a scale. But like clearly, if the page is 100% auto-generated and aren't some unique, filtering algorithms to add value or some other level, then basically it doesn't add any value to the searcher. So, either the searcher gets stuck having to make an extra click by stopping through that sort of site, or they click the back button and have to click on something else. It's not a good user experience if a user searches a search engine and then just gets another list of 100% auto-generated
But
results.
doesn't Google see this, or do you feel that they're missing it because they've got too much to look at, or you think they actively see that this is happening by the big sites and they're turning a blind eye to it because it's a big site run by a friend of a friend who we might buy in the future?
It might. I don't think. Well, first, I would say that I don't think they'll ever buy that site, the one we were just mentioning. I don't see that happen. I don't see that being remotely possible. Yahoo might make a crazy acquisition like that because they have a string of bad acquisitions, but I wouldn't see Google doing that. But I think it's more that as Google becomes more of a dominant player in the web ecosystem, that they to some part are fearful of people who are good at public relations and people who have access to, capital and power and authority because they want to protect their own brand, and they don't want to be accused of being a monopoly or acting like a monopoly. Like one of the companies that sued Google over in Europe, I think it was like eJustice or something, is actually if you go to the website, it's a Google custom powered search engine, and they're suing Google because Google's not indexing its own results. And that's kind of crazy. But at the same time, they don't want to do much other high profile stuff in a way that makes it look like they're being abusive because it's just going to work against them. And now Microsoft's funding, whatever legal interests need be to kind of put pressure on them.
I see. So what you're saying is that all those times that Jason Calacanis railed against Google Knoll and said that Google was potentially competing with publishers, and all those times that he stood up for other big causes, he was building his reputation as a crusader in addition to being an entrepreneur. And Google is saying, we don't want to fight a crusader. We don't want to fight a guy who's so high profile, has such a big voice. Let's deal with the smaller guys who don't have that.
It's much easier to do something to someone when they don't have any effective way to retaliate.
How do you know that? How it sounds compelling, but
Whereas
how do you know this is true?
observations and experiences,
All right.
it's hard, right? The more specific you get, the weirder it
I'll tell you
gets.
why,
But it's
because
I
it
mean
seems
you
to
you
me
can
that
see
they
how
it seems to me that they could
right?
say it seems to me that just as you saw 300 to 400,000 pages that were essentially computer generated, wrapped in advertising, meant to do nothing more than grab traffic from Google to send it to this landing page that would hopefully then send the users who end up on that tra on that page to a Google ad. It seems to me that if you saw that Google would see it and they would say, okay, we don't want to get into a fight with all of Jason Calacanis's business and his whole megaphone against us, but we do want to say these 300 to 400,000 pages, we're not going to index. We'll focus on the rest of the business. He's not going to get upset. He's going to see that this is the way we do business. Everybody's happy, including Aaron Wall and his followers. Why wouldn't they do something like that? Is it that they just didn't catch? Why wouldn't they do something like that?
Because a lot of it, and this was also in that Shoe Money sort of video, a lot of it's about the perception. You know, Google's algorithm is kind of their magic, and if you show that you heavily manipulate or something, they'll torch you for it. Now, whereas with some of the like bigger sites, one of the things that I'll compliment Jason for is he does a very good job of publicly acting naive about what he's trying to do, so that there's some wiggle room there. However, I mean, a lot of sites, if you Google has remote quality rater guidelines, and a lot of, and you can read through them and see what they say is value add or what's not value add. So it's not just whether or not, 20 Google engineers in the quality team or 100 engineers.
Let's see if we lost them, I'll piece it back together again. Me call him right
Can you hear
back.
me?
Yeah, there we go. Sorry, we lost you. I was going to call you right back. Last thing I heard was it's not just X number of engineers sitting in a room. Can you pick it up from there?
Okay. Yeah, sure. So it's not just like X number of engineers sitting in a room that have to catch it, but they also have like over 10,000 remote quality raters that look through the web and grade stuff. So there's a lot of different ways for a lot of the bad stuff to come up and be seen. It's just sometimes it's given a lot of benefit of the doubt, and then sometimes it's not.
Okay. All right, so let me see what we learned. Well, actually, one more thing. First of all, I think
Okay.
when you stand up for content creators, Aaron, can you hear me or did we lose the connection again?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, great. When you stand up for content creators, I appreciate it because I have done searches for my own work and discovered that some scraper website ends up showing up at the top of the search results and not me. Because they figured out how to grab my videos and add tags to them, and because of that, they're gonna end up with my traffic. And I'm upset by that. But as an interviewer, I have to ask more questions here. I have to challenge a little bit. And I wonder if maybe these
Okay.
guys are adding some value. Maybe these sites are taking Andrew Warner's video and they're adding proper tags and they're making it more searchable and they're helping Google and they're helping Google's users. And at the end of the day, the user doesn't care that Andrew put in the work. They care about who is the easiest to find, who has the best layout. And if it's not Andrew, the guy who created it, screw Andrew. We've got to go with the other person. So maybe Google is making the right decision here. What do you
Well,
think of that?
if you, well, that's exactly what the founders of YouTube thought when they described their tactics as whatever tactics, however evil, you know. So
They
that's how they
describe their
internally
tactics as
described their
whatever
own
tactics,
methods
whatever
of,
evil.
whatever tactics, however evil. That's how Mr. Chen, I think that's his name, described in the internal emails about them trying to grow their traffic as quickly as they could for selling out, to sell out to Google for a big number. So the point is, though, if the original content creators aren't really aren't making a living off of it, and it's mostly just parasitic crap, then some of those original content creators are going to go away. And then eventually, here's where it gets scary, is when the top 10 search results are like kind of like Mahalo, eHow, associated content, whatever, then when people go to make more content, and if people start researching off this base of kind of autogen or content written by non-topical experts and that sort of stuff, well, the web collectively as a whole just starts losing utility. It doesn't happen in one day, however. Over time, it's certainly either search is getting better and the web's getting better, or it can get more sick. And one of Google's biggest problems is figuring out how to get the economics to work to get the best content in its index and keep it in there.
All right. Okay. All right, that's a great point. So let's do this then. I don't want to just bitch and moan about Mahalo and the big guys. It's not in my nature, as you know. I want to say, okay, if there's something out there that works, what can I learn from it? And what can my audience learn from it? So let's now shift to what we can learn from your experience and from what you've observed other people do properly when it comes to SEO. I'll tell you a couple of things that I noticed here when you and I are talking. First, having capital, having good backing is going to help you with sites like Google. It's going to help you with your traffic. It's going to help you experiment a little bit more than if you were just a small site. Guys who are unfunded keep ragging on being funded. Here's another reason why being funded helps. Here's other thing I heard. Go out there and make a name for yourself. Get that megaphone for yourself. I used to wonder, why is it that Jason Calacanis is wasting all his time building up this reputation as a fighter, blogging, emailing, videoing himself, and doing all this stuff? Now you're showing me that there's a direct business benefit that helps out his company. And I'd say everybody in the audience here needs to go out there and keep building up their megaphone, needs to get it bigger and bigger and bigger. What else? You take it from there. What other tips can somebody who's in my audience right now, Moses, Adam, Ravish, GCam, Ted, Casey Allen, what can all these guys who are running sites do to grow their traffic from search engines?
So one of the tips that's pretty good is to have a good domain name, because a lot of the search engines place a lot of weight on the anchor text and links. And so if you own mykeywords.com or whatever, it's really easy to build links using your keywords in it. Whereas if you conversely owned, get-the-best-credit-cards-now.info, you own something like that and you're going around using anchor text as credit cards or whatever, it kind of look kind of spammy. Yep. So if you use a domain name that matches your keywords, that helps out a lot. There's also some engines also put a weighting directly on the domain name too. So that's one thing that helps a lot. Another is kind of the idea that once you have domain authority, once you have a bunch of good inbound links, once you have an audience, you can try to leverage that in any way that kind of makes sense for you. So if you know you're starting off a new site and it's brand new, no one says that anyone has to launch a crappy, thin, Me Too e-commerce site. Leave it at that. You know, you could just as well launch a blog about the industry you're in, you know, and then 3 months or 6 months or 12 months later add an e-commerce store to it. So it's kind of the order of operations matters there too. So if whatever you're doing isn't remarkable and isn't likely to be remarked about and nobody cares about it, then don't make that the focus of what you're doing. Just make that be a side bit of the project. Sort of like what you mentioned with Jason is, you know, he's always, whatever the cause is, you know, rally for this or that or whatever. And the idea there is if you build up enough, you know, awareness and momentum or whatever, you can kind of monetize it however you want.
Okay. So you're saying before you build a store, build the megaphone, build the remarkable conversation, and then go on and build the store, right? So you could get some links.
Yep. And then also if you can't get exposure in a certain space, if you're trying to get exposure in a certain space and you can't really get it, a good option is to try to give exposure to the people you want exposure from and hope for some bit of reciprocity out of it. So some of the more interesting pieces of content you'll see, some of them have inputs through like group interviews or interviews of individuals who are already well known. And then if some of them link back to you, that helps quite a bit.
I see. I obviously do interviews here a lot. I ask the people who I interviewed to link back to me after I do the interview. In fact, I give them the whole video with a request for a link back. I say, you can post the interview on your site, but I'd also appreciate a link back. Does that help the fact that I might get, if I do 20 interviews a month, maybe 15 of them linking back? It seems like such a puny number of links.
But they're huge authority links, and if they market it to their audiences, those audiences pick up on you. So there's some spots where you build a crappy link and the crappy link is all there ever is and that's all it's ever going to amount to. But if you're interviewing people that are popular who have audiences, you're not just getting that link, you're getting that link and then a bit of that audience. And over time that adds up quite a bit. So, you know, you may say you're only getting 15 links a month or something, but at the same time, they're links that have a lot of traffic associated with them. So, like, I've ran into your site many times.
Yeah, thank you, by the way. Before this interview, you linked to me. I know that I did an interview with the founder of Y Combinator, Paul Graham. He put a link to my interview on the front page of Y Combinator. I couldn't believe it. And yeah, so all those are great authority, and it has helped me get traffic. That's my biggest source of traffic right now. Links from people who I've interviewed. What else? What else can somebody who's not doing an interview, who wants to say, you know, Andrew, I've listened to this program for about 45, I don't know where we are, maybe 50 minutes into it. I want to go out and do something that will pay off, that will make all this time that I spent with Andrew and Aaron pay off. What's the one thing they can go and do right now?
So a lot of it comes down to doing research up front to make sure you're entering the sort of right market. Just because a lot of people are in a market doesn't mean it's necessarily the best market to enter. And so an example of that, like if you had an idea of, like, hey, I'm going to start a blog about SEO. That was a pretty good idea towards the end of 2003. Maybe not so good of an idea right now, just because it's like those people aren't very receptive to ads. There's already 1,000 other sites you're going to be competing with. So if you can find, there's a post Brian Clark made called, I think, something like How to Dominate Your Niche or something like that. And the basic concept is if you're in an area where you feel that there's this hierarchy of competition and you're at the bottom, and there's all these people above you doing the same thing, then try to think of a kind of an end around sort of way to approach your market to where you don't have so many competitors. So his example is he wanted to create a blog about blogging, but then he didn't want to be the number three player behind Darren Rouse's Pro Blogger and the site started by Nick W. I just forgot the name of it right now, Performancing, I believe. And then he didn't want to be number three there, so he read what they were writing about, and it was about copywriting stuff. So he made a blog that was just kind of more about copywriting stuff rather than just a blog about blogging. So it's kind of a different niche, and so it's a parallel. So like within SEO, there's people who have made a name for themselves focusing on like local and search stuff. There's people who've made a name for themselves focusing on like video, focusing on stuff like video search. So the key is if you don't have a lot of resources off the start, doesn't necessarily mean you need to raise funding, but maybe you just need tighter branding, and a tighter topic focus until you get well known, and then you can start spreading out with it.
All right, what else?
Another thing you can do off the start.
Let's
Okay,
suppose
go ahead.
that you're
Listen.
already in business, you already are either selling something or you've got a content site that you're building, and you need to find a way to get more traffic, more people to come over to the site, because it's so lonely when you're building a website and there's nobody out there looking at it. What do you do if you're already up and running?
So even if you're already up and running, it doesn't mean you can't add pieces onto it. So some people go, well, I have an e-commerce store. And it's like, okay, well, you can have an e-commerce store with the blog and tools and this and that. Like if you think about like how SEO books started, I wasn't necessarily resource rich back then. That was like a copy of movable type. And the initial version of it was a 90, well, actually the initial version was just one of their default templates. The second version was a $99 logo with kind of me trying to color match the CSS for like 10 minutes. And then over time, that eventually became the membership site with all the tools and forums and all the other stuff. So if people are ever sitting around saying that they don't have anything to do or that, their site's boring or it's not remarkable, I don't think that mindset or approach is the best one. It's usually you have to figure out, keep trying stuff and eventually some of it's going to work. You can also, like, if even if a keyword or an idea isn't that profitable, you can still create content about it. And if you make really great content about it and can get exposure for it, then that link equity can help the other pages in your site rank better too.
Saad is saying he's hearing a lot of what we're saying towards the end of the interview here, and he's saying, man, is it just me or does SEO take too long? What about that? That a few years ago it used to be easy. Now you're competing against guys like Mahalo that have millions of dollars behind them. You're competing against Demand Media. You're competing against all the students that you've taught out there. Maybe this just doesn't pay off so much anymore.
And the more people who think that, the more money I'll make. So, but the thing is, that's a good point is, okay, so it's not instantaneous feedback. The good news is the lack of instantaneous and transparent feedback is also part of why there's a sustainable profit margin there. So imagine the alternative that it was, well, it's really fast, anybody can do it. Suddenly it's a $3 a day job outsourced to someone in China, And so it's good that to some degree the opacity or the I can't say the word right, the fact that it's opaque is actually somewhat good in that it means that there can be sustainable profit margins. And it doesn't have to take a long time. Like once you already have a site that's up and running, if you already have a good trusted site, then you can add stuff to it and have it do well pretty quickly, in the first month or so. Now,
Like
if you're
what?
starting from scratch, it'll take. Well, you can find out that there's a certain area that monetizes well. And you can test articles about any topic on your website once your site's trusted. And then simply, if you got analytics, you can get the feedback and you go, that's too competitive, I can't rank for that. Or, that's, wow, I can rank for that. Let's see what else is in that space. And there's programs like AdSense, so it's not hard to at least get a baseline idea if you can make any revenue off the traffic. And then from there, you can try to do, affiliate marketing or whatever else. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can absolutely hear you. I'm feeling the pressure of the time, and I'm seeing that there are a lot of questions coming in. How about this? I'll give people a way of asking you questions afterwards. If can I pass on to you maybe the best one or two questions that we get, maybe a few more if they're really solid?
Sure, and can I show you one more kind of cool SEO tip?
Yeah, I'd love it. 100%.
Okay, so if you go to the search results themselves can be a bit of an SEO tool. So if you search for a topic, say you search for like credit cards or something like that, well, if you look, they try to complete the search credit or the search query for you, and they'll show you some of the breakdown keywords there. Then they also have a show options link. And if you look at the show options link, there's a link on there for related searches, and that'll show you a bunch of different related keywords and concepts. And then you can look at the page titles of the existing listings in the search results. And between the three of those, you're seeing what other people are trying to target in their page titles, what the related keywords are that Google's suggesting, people starting the search query complete with, and then other related keywords. Between the three of those, it can really help you get some good ideas of how to optimize a page title. And what's interesting when you use that sort of strategy is, let's say you don't have the authority to rank for credit cards, but maybe you can rank for instant credit cards or credit cards for fair credit or some of the other concepts like that. Well, then over time, as the site gets more authoritative, then you can end up ranking for a broad array of keywords and then eventually build up towards ranking to the core keywords. So even if you don't have tons of authority right off the start, you don't just lose by not ranking for the main keyword. You still are pulling in traffic from some of the other ones.
I love it. Let's see. Dan Blank in the audience is saying, "I love how Aaron wants to just keep sharing even more." I do too. I really appreciate it. Aaron, I'm grateful to you for not just coming here and doing an interview, but people don't realize this. You and I have now spent an hour and a half together. The first, I think, 20 minutes were in deep tech support mess, and I'm so grateful to you for even sticking with that and figuring out a way for us to continue on and do this interview. And I see all the questions, some of them from really supportive people in my community here. If you guys post them on foundersmix.com, MixerG's new community site, tag them with Aaron Wall or SEO Book. I will take the best ones and I'll pass them on to him. So, and Aaron, I'll pick out the best ones for you so you don't have to go through all of them. But of course, you're welcome to, and I'll link you to all of them if you'd like that too. Aaron, how can people go and find more information from you? How can they learn from you?
So we have, of course, so on our site, we have a 7-day like intro to SEO thing that comes with a couple of free SEO tools. And that's at seobook/free-account. Or if they just go to our homepage and click the join link, that'll start them there. And then if they want to like interact directly with us and be part of our community with the forums and the training modules and all that other stuff, then there's an upgrade link too, and they can become a member that way.
Okay. All right. Guys, if you do that, I want to hear from you what you think of it. So send me an email. Let me know what you thought of the program. I haven't heard anyone say anything negative about it, but I'm open to hearing both. From what I understand, Aaron, you've really helped people get a lot of traffic. This guy, Christmas, in the audience, whose chat I've lost over here, has talked about how much traffic he got from being a member. I'm not getting anything for recommending people become members. I'm just saying that this is a guy who's well known in the industry. This is a guy who's helped out a lot of people. And, I think you should go and check out his site, SEObook.com. Aaron, thank you again. Guys, thank you for being out there. I'm Andrew. I'll see you all in the comments.